WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Larry Adler, the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He began his musical career in vaudeville in 1928. He went on to play with musicians and performers like George Gershwin, Fred Astaire, Jack Benny, and Duke Ellington. But Adler is also at home in the concert hall performing music by Bach, Beethoven, and Liszt with the world's major symphonies. He's had works written for him by Ralph Vaughan Williams and Darius Milhaud. It's been said of Adler's musicianship that what he can't do on the harmonica can't be done. And Adler has said of his own work that he would like his epitaph to repeat what Billie Holiday once said to him, "You don't play that thing, you sing it." Larry Adler grew up in Baltimore in an Orthodox Russian-Jewish family. He now lives in London, where he moved in the early 50s after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. Larry Adler has written an autobiography. It's titled "It Ain't Necessarily So." Larry Adler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of you. I may as well start off telling you right
now. What did I do?
Oh, you cleaned up the Billie Holiday story.
No, I know. I took out the expletive.
Yeah, why can't we tell it this way? She heard me play with Duke Ellington, and then Duke took me over, and he said, "Larry, this is Billie Holiday." And I put out my hand to say, "How do you do?" And she says, "Man, you don't play that bleeping thing, you sing it." Now, see, you can get it that way.
Okay, well, thanks. you shame me. Well, you have brought your harmonica with you. And before we talk about your life, I'd love for you to maybe play a pop song for us, and maybe I'll ask you to do some classical music.
All right, I'll tell you what, you name the song and I'll play it. Anything you like.
How about something by Rodgers and Hart or Gershwin? Give you your choice.
Do you know what chorus I'm about to go into?
No, is that the verse?
That's the verse.
Oh, and I was trying to figure out why I didn't recognize it.
All right, here comes the chorus.
Okay. Great. My Funny Valentine.
Now, see, nobody knows the verse. So nobody knows that verse leads into that chorus.
That's great.
I don't think anybody knows the verse of anything.
You know, your tone is so different than the kind of tone that blues players have.
Mm-hmm.
You really have a different kind of vibrato.
Oh, yes, quite.
It's a completely different kind of tone.
Well, you must remember, my tone is the sum total, probably, of every musician I ever admired. Yasha Heifetz, Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, Andre Segovia, Django Reinhardt, Louis Armstrong, all of them, Bill Evans, all of them shape my playing, because the minute I admire a musician, something rubs off.
The way you tell it in your autobiography, you ran away from home when you were 14 in the hopes of joining Borominovich and his harmonica band. And I think it's a pretty brave thing to run away when you're 14. But why did you have to run away to do it?
Well, I certainly couldn't have gotten permission from my mother and father. They wouldn't let me at the age of 14 go to New York. And I wanted to get away. And I had won this mouth organ competition. I was Baltimore's mouth organ champion. I read in the paper, Lawrence Cecil Adler, this is the man you're talking to, is the champion of Baltimore. And boy, I believed it. Went right to my head. And I was stage struck. I'd seen Al Jolson. I'd seen Eddie Cantor. I'd also heard Rachmaninoff. I'd seen Otto Klemperer conduct. I wanted to do what they did. And the best way was to get on the stage somehow. Now, I had about $50 my parents didn't know about because I sold Liberty magazines. So simply, without telling them, I went down to Union Station in Baltimore, got on a train. I had met a musician named Nat Brusiloff who'd made the great mistake of saying to me, if you ever come to New York, kid, look me up. He didn't know because I looked him up. And the poor man had to take care of me.
Well, you never made it into the Borominovich band.
Well, that was thanks to Borominovich because I auditioned for him. And I played my guts out, because this, to me, this was the epitome. This was God. And I played the Beethoven Minuet in G, which was the piece that I'd used to win the Baltimore Mouth Organ Competition. And when I finished playing, Mr. Minovich said, kid, you stink. I started to cry. I still can't imagine the savagery of talking to a young kid like that. And Bora had a dwarf in his band named Johnny Paleo. And Johnny said, Bora, why don't you let the kid come on with us for one show? And Minovich says, get him out of here. He stinks. Now, how does one go on from there? That is the thing that
baffled how did you go on after that?
Well, I got on a streetcar. They had streetcars in those days. And I was going down to Penn Station. And I intended to go back to Baltimore because if Minovich didn't want me, what future was there? When the streetcar got to the Paramount Theater on Broadway, there was Rudy Valli's name in lights, and I remembered hearing him on the radio, and on impulse, I got off the streetcar, sneaked past the doorman, played to Valli, who put me on that night at his nightclub, where I flopped. It didn't mean a thing, but Valli had noticed me. He didn't say, kid, you stink. So on the strength of that minute encouragement, I stayed on, and within a week, I had a job on the Paramount circuit, including, by the way, playing in Philadelphia. And I played 44 weeks, doing 4, 5, and 6 shows a day, and that's how I began.
You were in vaudeville for quite a while. What was your act like, and what were some of the roles you had to take on in the act?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing, because when I first had this contract with Paramount, and I tried to do an act, well, I didn't have an act. I didn't know how to do an act. And it was the comedian in the show. It was a traveling road show. He thought of the idea of making me a local boy. So in 44 cities, I was a local boy. I was a local boy in Philadelphia. I was a local boy in Chicago and Denver. And I used to get the most applause of anyone on the bill because this is our local boy. Give him a big hand. So the other act hated my guts, but there I was, local boy, making good. One thing that does puzzle me, in those days we did not use microphones and there were stage bands. How in hell could they hear me? A mouth organ has very little projection power. And yet, when I finished playing, they applauded. So do you suppose, and this is one theory, did they listen better in those days? Without the amplification, they would have to listen to hear the sound, and maybe that is the explanation.
Maybe that's it. You were exposed to a lot of sex when you were pretty young.
Oh, still? You don't think I've given it up, do you?
No, but I'm thinking this 14 and 15-year-old in the middle of vaudeville, and people would take you to sex shows. And
only one, really. When we got to New Orleans, there was a big sexual exhibition, and the people on my bill and the people at the RKO Theater, we chipped in and hired what was called a circus. And because I was only 14 or 15 years old, they didn't make me pay. That was my first freebie, a sexual circus. And I sat there and I watched these incredible things going on that I didn't know existed. And I think, in a way, it almost put me off sex.
Oh, really? Because it was so crass.
It was scary. It wasn't pleasurable at all. And also, even as a kid, I think I was aware of people being exploited. I didn't like it. I've never liked striptease dancers, for example. I feel that they're being used and exploited. I didn't like that sex show. I don't like strippers. I don't like anything where people are made use of and they're not individuals anymore.
Well, did you feel exploited in vaudeville?
No, I wasn't exploited in my act.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? What kind of music did you play in the act?
I did Button Up Your Overcoat and an impression of Helen Cain singing I Want to Be Loved by You. That was my act, just those two numbers. Then later on, I got rid of the Helen Cain number and I played When Day Is Done. And you and I were talking before about this new record that's come out, Larry Adler Live at the Ballroom. I suggested they call it Larry Adler Dead in the Bathroom. I think it would be just as good a title. But on that record, I play When Day Is Done exactly as I played it when I was 14. And when I listened to it, I thought, hey, Adler, you really haven't improved a bit.
How did you break into pop music, an American popular song, playing Rodgers and Hart, meeting the Gershwins?
Well, mind you, look who was around in those days. Yeah. Not only Rodgers and Hart, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen. These people were like Schubert and Mendelssohn. They just wrote wonderful things, and you wanted to play them. Now, I was in Gus Edwards' act. It was a kiddie act. And while I was with him at the Palace, Paul Whiteman was playing at the Roxy with his own film, The King of Jazz. And I was dying to have Whiteman listen to me. So between my shows, I would go up to the Roxy and stand outside the stage door, and whoever came in or out, I'd blow the mouth organ in their face, hoping someone said, what a talented little boy this is. Well, finally someone did. Frankie Trumbauer, the very, very famous saxophone player, took me into Whiteman's dressing room. He says, Paul, listen to this kid. So I played Poet and Peasant. And when I finished playing it, Whiteman said, let me hear you play the Rhapsody in Blue. I was 15. I couldn't handle the Rhapsody in Blue. But I was a very arrogant, snotty little kid, and success has not changed me. I couldn't let him know that I didn't know Rhapsody in Blue and that it was too tough for me. So I said, I don't like Rhapsody in Blue. So he turns to a young man I hadn't noticed before, and he said, how do you like that, George? And that's how I met Gershwin.
Were you friends after that?
Well, that was the end of that, because right. I got out fast. But right. However, about 3 years later, a man named Jules Glenzer, who was the vice president of Cartier, he gave me a farewell party. I was going to England for the first time. This was 1934. And at this party, there was Johnny Green, there was Harold Arlen, there was Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, and with them all, I played a song of theirs. Now, I knew that sooner or later I was going to play something with George, and then our host, Jules Glenzer, said, Larry and George are going to play the Rhapsody in Blue. Well, by now, I'd heard it so many times, it was in my head, and I've got a very good ear. If it's in my head, I can play it. So George sat at the piano, I started to play, and when we finished playing, George got up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, the goddamn thing sounds as if I wrote it for you. Now, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because to me, the goddamn thing still does sound that way. And in my act now, I have a piano roll made by George Gershwin. That is on that record also. And I put scotch tape over the melody line. It sounds literally as if Gershwin is accompanying me. It's wonderful, and it's an eerie feeling.
You toured with Jack Benny for a long time. Did you ever play music comedy with him? We all remember his attempts at being a violin virtuoso.
Well, we would do a duet together, and Jack would hit one note like this, then me on the mouth organ. Jack. Jack. All that one note. And it was very funny. And I probably learned as much from Jack Benny as one could learn from any individual performer because, first of all, he was an encyclopedia. And he gave me advice once in two words, which is the most valuable lesson I think you could ever learn in show business. And the two words are, don't press. And boy, that is a hard lesson to learn because if you're playing for an audience that doesn't like you, the impulse is work harder, win them over. He says do just the opposite, relax, wait for them to find you.
Huh.
Oh, it takes you a long time to learn that.
Well, he had some of the best timing in all of show business.
Is nothing like Jack's timing.
And one of the subtlest performers.
Yes. And also, he was one of the most considerate of people. See, I did three overseas tours with Jack Benny during World War II. And he encouraged me to do comedy. And if I got a bigger laugh than Jack, to him that just made the show better. There's many a comedian I know who, if you got a bigger laugh than they, you were out. You were fired. That was not Jack's way.
My guest is Larry Adler, harmonica virtuoso, and author of a new autobiography titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Larry Adler is my guest. He's the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He's performed with Fred Astaire, George Gershwin, Jack Benny, as well as with symphonies around the world. He moved to England after being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. He's written an autobiography. It's titled It Ain't Necessarily So. We should talk about your classical music playing. We've talked a little bit about vaudeville and pop. Very, very few people have played classical music on the harmonica. Why did you drift toward that?
I was always inclined toward the classical because the first musical impression I think I ever had was Sergei Rachmaninoff. An uncle took me to a recital of his at the Lyric Theater in Baltimore. And I believe that I can still remember the impression that that magnificent musician made on this little kid, 5 years old. And when I first played with the Baltimore Symphony, in the same building where I heard Rachmaninoff, I remember walking around the hall, seeing if I could remember where I was sitting to hear Rachmaninoff. But once having heard Rachmaninoff, I wanted to play classical music. And then I heard Yasha Heifetz, I heard Pablo Casals. Well, of course I wanted to do what they did. This was great music I was listening to. And it didn't occur to me to consider whether or not the instrument was right for it. If I wanted to do it, that was my medium. And I thought that I would be able to express myself on it, and I think I do.
It must have been hard getting accepted.
Oh, I don't think I'm accepted yet. I commissioned a work from Khachaturian, and he said to me, I'll go back to Russia, I will tell people about you, and they will not believe me. I said, well, why shouldn't they believe you? He said, because in Russia, small boys play their garmushka on street corners, and no one will believe that you can play classical music on the mouth organ. And that is still the general feeling. I mean, people, friends of mine, I've known them for years. Let's say they haven't heard me for 3 or 4 years. They hear me. Larry, it's amazing what you get out of that little thing. Well, that's the big cliche. I've been getting music out of that little thing for 59 professional years.
Can I ask you to play some classical music for us now?
You can ask
Bach,
me. Maybe I won't answer you.
Well, let's try.
What would you like?
Something by Bach?
By Bach, sure.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Several composers have written works for you.
Yes.
And I'm sure those were composers who had never written for your instrument. What did you have to tell them about how to play harmonica and what a harmonica can or can't do?
I would lay out a diagram showing the limitations and capability. Like, for example, Vaughan Williams, I gave him a diagram showing which intervals, which chords were possible, which ones you couldn't play. And Vaughan Williams told me he pasted my instructions on his shaving mirror. And while he shaved, he would study what to write and what not to write. When the work was finished, there were a few things he'd written that were unplayable. For example, He had me playing C and F together. And you can't do that because you exhale C and you inhale F. And even with my two heads, I've never been able to figure out a way to do that. So I went down to Dorking, where he lived, after I'd received the manuscript. And I said, Mr. Vaughan Williams, please forgive me, but there are certain things in the work that do not lie naturally for the mouth organ. And he interrupted me. He says, so you don't like what I wrote, eh? Well, I wasn't saying that at all. But of course, I know now he was doing this for effect. He was, in his way, he was like Jack Benny. He says, well, if you don't like the way I wrote it, and he paused in that timing, and he says, I'll change it. And if you like it the second time, I'll revise it once more. But if you don't like it the third time, I'm going to rescore the whole bloody thing for bass tuba.
Would it be imposing to ask you to play a line or two that one of the composers wrote for you?
Well, here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams. Now, he used the chord possibility of the mouth organ better than almost any other composer. And here's the beginning of the Vaughan Williams Romance for mouth organ, piano, and strings. You see how he uses the chord possibilities.
Yeah.
Now, against that, he has a steady B double flat, and it just sounds wonderful to hear the bass note of the B double flat and those chords you just heard me play.
When you play with an orchestra, the orchestra has to tune to you. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the only man who ever gave me a hard time was your own ex-conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony, Eugene Ormandy. There was the Ford Symphony Hour. And Mr. Ormandy was the conductor, and I was going to be the soloist playing the Vivaldi A minor concerto, the Vivaldi violin concerto. And I heard later he did not want to conduct for me at all, and he tried to get me canceled. But we each had a contract. Mine was as valid as his. Now, he rehearsed the orchestra and didn't let me come out until the last 10 minutes of rehearsal time, which was really awful. So I came out, and I gave my aid to the violinist, and Ormandy says, what is this? I said, well, you see, they have to tune to me. The mouth organ is the fixed reed. I cannot tune to them. He said, this is ridiculous. And I've never talked back to a conductor. I'm a coward anyway. But I said to him, Mr. Ormandy, I have played this work with this orchestra last year. If it embarrasses you to conduct it, I think we could do it without you.
Oh, I'm sure you got a great response to
that. Oh, the orchestra loved it.
Oh, dear. So what happened?
Well, he conducted it perfectly well for me, but he didn't talk to me after the concert.
I'm sure. Geez, you know, I would have liked to see you when you were 10 years old and you were a cantor.
Oh, I was so cute. You would have loved me. I was the most adorable little schmuck you have ever seen in your life.
Well, you were a 10-year-old, and for any listeners who don't know what a cantor is, the cantor is the person who conducts the singing part of the religious ceremony in a Jewish temple. Well, and I'm wondering if you did that when you were 10 for reasons of show business or religion.
No. What had happened was I was in a choir in Baltimore, and at the end of the high holidays, they gave each choir boy a gold watch, which I found very unsatisfactory. There was a choir on the synagogue across Druid Hill Park where they paid money. So I went over there and auditioned for them and got in their choir. Religion had nothing to do with it. Now, the cantor, his name was Adolf Weissgall, decided to create a children's synagogue and had me as the cantor. And I must admit that during my term as cantor, I was so religious. But then, during my term as cantor, I became 13. I was bar mitzvah, which meant I was a man. And I lost my job as cantor, and the religion began to fall away as of that moment.
There's no money or fame in it anymore.
I lost my power base.
Could you have played, do you think, a conventional instrument?
Well, I studied the piano, and I studied at the Peabody Conservatory, and I have a unique distinction, the sole student ever to have been expelled from Peabody. I had prepared a waltz by Grieg, and when I came up on the stage to play it, the principal of the school said, "And what are we going to play, my little man?" So I went to the piano and I played, "Yes, We Have No Bananas." And my parents got a letter, "Don't send him back." But I was fascinated by the piano. I would love to have been a concert pianist, but equally I know I would never have had the discipline that it requires to practice 6 to 8 hours a day to become a concert pianist. I'm a very good drawing room pianist, very good indeed, and my harmonies are good, my interpretation is fine, but I would never have become a concert pianist.
It takes discipline for the harmonica.
No, not as much, because, you see, there was no precedent. There was no Yasha Heifetz. Nobody could say, "Make like Rachmaninoff." There was no Rachmaninoff at the mouth organ. If there was, I was it.
I see what you mean. You returned to performing in the States. I think it was in the mid-70s, after you left the United States because you were blacklisted. You couldn't get any jobs here. Did it take till the mid-70s until it was okay for you to perform here?
Not quite as bad as that. I came back in 1959, and I played at the Village Gate, a nightclub in New York. And I played a few others, such as The Hungry Eye in San Francisco and Mr. Kelly's in Chicago. But it didn't really catch on. These engagements were okay individually, but it didn't create a demand for me. Then I came back again in the 60s to do a film score in Hollywood. And Isaac Stern had introduced me to Saul Hurock, who said he would try to book a tour for me. And he could only get 3 concerts in about 6 months. And he said, "Larry, you've got to face facts. Concert committees are run by Republican ladies with long memories."
Right. So you're still living in England and you're going to stay there?
I still live there. I most certainly am going to stay there. I like it very much. I think England, with all its faults, is the most civilized country I know.
Well, I'm glad you're back to perform, if not to live. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed the interview.
Thanks. A pleasure to being here.